Welcome to the St. Andrew Sunday Morning Sermon Podcast. You can connect with us online at www.gostandrew.com.
Today's scripture readings are from Psalm 84 and Hebrews chapter 11 and 12. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. Hear my prayer, Lord God Almighty. Listen to me, God of Jacob. By faith, Abraham, when put to the test, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises was ready to offer up his only son, of whom he had been told, "It is through Isaac that descendants shall be named for you." He considered the fact that God is able even to raise someone from the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked blessings for the future on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each one of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave instructions about his burial. By faith, Moses was hidden by his parents for 3 months after his birth because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was growing up, refused to be called a son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered abuse suffered for the Christ to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, unafraid of the king's anger, for he persevered as though he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as if it were dry land, but when the Egyptians attempted to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had received the spies in peace. And what more should I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, refusing to accept release in order to obtain a better resurrection. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned to death. They were sawn in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, persecuted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and in holes in the ground. Yet all these, though they were commended for their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better, so that they would not, apart from us, be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith.
26.2. It sounds like just a number to most people, but in the world of running, it's a number that separates the weekend warriors from the insanely committed. Anyone who's ever run a marathon and crossed the finish line will tell you that it's a profoundly spiritual experience. It breaks you down and takes you deep into that unexplored territory of your mind and soul, where you're all alone with yourself, where your weakness is exposed and your vulnerabilities are laid bare. When I ran my very first marathon in Los Angeles several years ago, I had no idea that there would be thousands of cheerleaders lining the streets, children standing on the corners giving high fives to runners, and strangers handing out food and water, musicians banging on drums and singing, and people of every language cheering you on as if you were Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. When you're in the middle of the race, too far out to turn around and too naive to realize what you've gotten yourself into, all of these enthusiastic supporters propel you and compel you to press on, to fight through the pain and self-doubt. And I expected to ride that wave of enthusiasm all the way to the finish line, but instead I discovered that the closer I drew to it, the quieter the crowds actually became. Their cheers grew subdued, their enthusiasm waned, as if they weren't sure if they should cheer for you or cry for you. And I remember turning a corner at around mile 20, suffering from this open blister that stretched from my big toe all the way to my heel, when I overheard someone in the crowd say, "Oh, geez, did you see that guy?" I was feeling like a bad accident on the highway, and the crowd of supporters became more like casual, curious onlookers. It's a poignant parable about life. When we're at mile two with the wind at our backs, we tend to have more friends than we could ever need. But when we're at mile 20, weary and suffering, the crowd often thins out and grows hush. And yet, isn't it there at mile 20 in your life journey that you need more than ever to have people around you to cheer you on across the finish line? According to the writer of Hebrews, we have those very people at our mile 20. They gather on the sidewalks and street corners. They fill the bleachers in the stadium around the track. All of these people of faith from generations past, whom the writer of Hebrews calls the great cloud of witnesses. When in life we find ourselves at mile 20 and the rest of the world grows quiet and indifferent, there is this crowd of people, invisible but ever present, cheering us on, holding their breath in anticipation, willing us across the finish line. Who are these people? Where does this great cloud of witnesses come from? Well, they are the people of faith from the past who have been to mile 20 themselves. People who know firsthand what it's like to turn the corner at mile 20 and not know for certain if they'll ever get across the finish line. The writer of Hebrews says that there are so many that he can't even list them all. He tries. He says, "By faith, Abraham offered up Isaac. By faith, Moses left Egypt. By faith, the Israelites passed through the Red Sea. By faith, Gideon and Barak, Samson and David, Samuel and all the prophets." And then he says, "You think you have problems? Well, you're not alone. These are the ones who've been there. They survived lions and fires and swords. They turned disadvantage into advantage. They won battles and they routed armies. Under torture, they refused to give in and go free. They braved abuse and beatings, chains and dungeons. Some were stoned, others sawed in two. Some wandered the earth in animal skins, homeless, friendless, powerless. And he says the world didn't deserve them. But they made their way, he says, as best they could on the cruel edges of the world. Who are these people? Well, we know who they were not before God got a hold of them, that is. They were not heroes. They were not saints. They were nothing but ordinary and imperfect people. Abraham was an old man, his best days presumably long behind him. Moses, a murderer and stutterer. The Israelites, slaves and doubters and complainers. David, an adulterer. Samuel, just a child. And Rahab. Did you catch this one in the story? Even Rahab makes this list. The one who was not a Jew, but a Canaanite. And a prostitute. I love that he includes Rahab in the list. This is a list of imperfect, unqualified, sketchy, and suspect characters whom God calls and uses to carry out God's purposes in the world. And now they cheer us on from the sidelines, wondering what God is going to do with us, wondering what line we will contribute to this divine drama that continues to unfold even today. The letter of Hebrews was written to early Christians who felt very much alone on their journey. They were like an endangered and threatened species, a tiny band of Christians hanging on by their fingernails on the fringes of the Roman Empire, making their way as best they could on the cruel edges of their world. They had endured purges and persecutions, even insults from their pagan neighbors. A tiny, insignificant sect on the verge of extinction, wondering to themselves, how on earth can we keep going? The answer to that question came to them in the form of a letter. Some say it was written by Paul, but we mostly do not know actually who wrote it. But it didn't matter because what the letter said was beautiful and believable. It said, "You're not the first to be here. Others came before you and they suffered adversity too, yet they kept running the race on faith, even though not a single one of them received as much for their faith as you already have. So remember your ancestors," he says, "and have courage." One of the best ways to keep moving forward in moments of hopelessness is to look back and remember that you're not the first to walk this path, nor will you be the last. And then to lean on the collective faith and wisdom of those who dared to believe in spite of the evidence, yet who by faith watched that very evidence change before their eyes. It's an inheritance that is ours, this ancient and enduring boldness and faith passed down through the ages. And if you listen close enough, you can hear them whisper their summons to you today. Lean in and listen. And you will hear them ask you, what will your contribution be? My father was 48 years old when he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. The doctor suggested a radical surgery that would buy my father perhaps a few years. Without the surgery, he would have only a few months at best. And there was this patient in that Los Angeles hospital, a stranger from Colorado Springs. His name was Frank. Frank was 6 weeks removed from the same surgery. He'd just been discharged from the hospital. And at the request of the doctor, he dropped in on my father to give encouragement, to try to lift his spirits. And Frank sat down with my father and talked about the surgery, the recovery, even the suffering that he endured. And then he lifted his shirt, revealing a scar that traveled from his chest to his navel and all the way around his back to his shoulder blade. And then he looked into my father's eyes and said, "Take it from someone who's been there. You can do this." We are not alone. Others in faith have been there before. And we think sometimes that we are the only one, that no one understands what we're going through, but for all these years, we've all ridden the back of this rogue planet together. We've all awakened to the same sunset and all dreamed the same dreams under the same moon. We've all fought the same battles with that same internal enemy, which most often is ourselves and our doubts and our fears. Even our prayers sound much the same. Our confessions, our laments, our pleas and petitions. We all know what it feels like to wonder out loud, how on earth can we keep going? And in moments of grace, there is someone from our distant past or even in our clouded present who says, "Take it from someone who's been there. You can do this." We often call such people saints, people of faith whose legacy now speaks across the ages, encouraging us to persevere. If they are saints, the writer of Hebrews reminds us that they are saints with a lowercase s. They are not so heroic that we cannot conceive of ourselves as being like them. They're just like you and me. It would be different if the writer of Hebrews had listed people like Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King Jr. or Dietrich Bonhoeffer or some other larger-than-life hero of the faith. Instead, he lists fairly ordinary people who lived their lives and trusted in God and endured faithfully through the hard times. Right around 2012, while I was still pastoring my last church in San Diego, I formed a unique relationship with one of the members there. His name was Ross. And Ross and his wife, Lorraine, had been members of that church in San Diego for about 25 years. And every Sunday, just before the services began, Ross would go out and unlock the bell tower and pull the long rope over and over, ringing the bells to announce to the whole community that worship was to begin. And one Friday morning, Ross came into my office. He handed over the key to the bell tower. Now in his mid-80s, he was ready to retire from his bell-ringing job. 5 days later, Ross died suddenly. It was as if he knew ahead of time what was coming. But in the months prior to his death, he gifted me with this little memoir of his, a self-published memoir full of stories and old photographs. One of the chapters in that little memoir was about his previous involvement in a new church startup in this little town called Littleton, Colorado. It was back in the 60s and 70s. In that church, Ross had served on the building committee. Lorraine taught Sunday school. With pride, he showed me in the memoir the before photos of the property and the after photos of a completed church building. At the time, the name and the location of the church meant little to me. It was the story that counted. And I had nearly forgotten about that story altogether. But one day, in my first year here at St. Andrew, I remembered that story. And I remembered Ross. And I remembered that it was Littleton. And so I went into the office and I searched through these old notebooks containing our church membership records here. And there I found his name, along with Lorraine's, date of membership, February 19th, 1967. It's a different building now. And yet when I walk the halls of St. Andrew, I think of Ross and Lorraine, whose spirit cheers every one of us on, even after all these years. The letter of Hebrews says, "By faith, Abraham offered up Isaac. By faith, Moses left Egypt by faith. The Israelites passed through the Red Sea by faith. Ross and Lorraine built a church. And then I hear this next line. By faith, Mark Feldmeyer, dot, dot, dot. By faith, Joe or Julie or Sandra or Kathy or just insert your name. And then ask yourself, what will my contribution be to God's unfolding drama? What line will I contribute to the story of what God is doing in this troubled but wonderful world? It's our time now. We're not the first, nor will we be the last. But here we are in the here and now. And those who come after us will look back at us in the same way that we now look back on our ancestors. And we can even hear them in the future asking us, what will our contribution be today? The writer of Hebrews lays out the assignment that we all now face. He says, throw off everything that hinders, everything that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race that's set before us. Get rid of everything that holds you back and fix your eyes on Jesus Christ, who says, I'm the perfect model, the one who wrote the book on what it means to look adversity square in the face and still have faith that moves mountains. Throw off everything that hinders and gets in the way and holds you back. And what is it that hinders and holds us back? I wonder if for most of us, like those early Christians in Rome, what holds us back is the fear of trusting in a vision that we cannot physically see. Fear that if we can't see ahead of time the promises that God holds out before us, we may not have the kind of strength necessary to endure the hardship required to inherit it. We wonder to ourselves, why can't God just give us some sign, something tangible that we can see, so that we can make it through this present adversity? But the writer of Hebrews reminds us, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. In faith, you may never see, at least not with any clarity or certainty, but you don't have to see. You need only a vision, and a vision is received not through these two eyes, but through the eyes of the heart. And it's the same vision that God gave our ancestors of old, the forerunners of the faith who now cheer us on. It's a promise that what today we know and see only dimly will one day be most fully revealed. How did the prophet Bilbo Baggins put it in The Lord of the Rings? The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with weary feet until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say. We cannot say where this road goes, but our forerunners can. And from the sidewalks and bleachers, they remind us, you can do this. No, you must do this. Because there's a whole generation coming after us that's depending on us and what we do now in this very moment. Nando Parado's book, Miracle in the Andes, tells the story of the Uruguayan rugby team and their friends and family members whose airplane crashed in the Andes Mountains in 1972. 29 passengers died. 16 survived the crash and spent 72 days on a glacier 12,000 feet above sea level, clinging to life in freezing temperatures with no hope of being rescued. Parado was one of two survivors who, after 62 days on the mountain, decided finally to trek across the frozen Andes back to civilization. The grueling trek took him 10 days and ultimately resulted in the rescue of all 16 survivors. In the book, he writes about a particular moment just after the crash as he held his dying sister in his arms and his hopes of survival began to fade. In the midst of this despair, he recalled a story that his father had told him many times when he was a child. As a young man, Parado's father had been one of Uruguay's top competitive rowers. And in one particular race, his father had pulled away from most of the field, but one rower had stayed with him. And they raced neck and neck, both of them straining with all their might to gain the slightest advantage. His father's lungs were burning, his legs seized with cramps. All he wanted to do was slump forward, gulp air into his lungs, and end his suffering. His father told himself, there will be other races. But then he glanced at his competitor in the skull beside him, and he saw the agony on his face. And his father said, I realized he was suffering as much as I was. So I decided I would suffer a little longer. His father won the race by 2 inches. And Prado says, when I was climbing on all those false summits and couldn't take one more step, I remembered that story and I said to myself, okay, this is when I have to push. Like my father, he said, I decided over and over again that I would suffer a little longer. The road goes ever on, and we must follow, if we can, even with weary feet. And where to then, we don't know. But God knows. So do the forerunners who've gone before us, and who now call to us to do whatever we can with the time that we have, to suffer a little more, daring to go wherever the road may lead. Our takeaways for today. We are surrounded every day by a great cloud of witnesses. God calls the ordinary and the imperfect. The future belongs to those who choose vision over sight.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's podcast. And if you'd like more information, go to www.gosaintandrew.com. See you next week.